White nose syndrome has killed over 5 million bats in North America, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Researchers know that the fungus strikes when the bats are hibernating, and not all species are affected. But so far, there is no cure, and scientists have mapped out how the disease moves from infection to death in the bats. They mapped it out. Finally, the secret is out, publishing it this week in BMC Physiology. David Bleihert is the branch chief of the Wildlife Disease Diagnostic Laboratory of the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin. He joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio Studios there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
This has been a mystery for quite a while, has it not?
Yes.
I remember we've been covering this story since, 1996, its first discovery?
About 2008.
2008.
Actually.
Wow.
Thankfully, it hasn't been quite that long yet.
Do we know why it suddenly turned up in 2008?
So all evidence to date suggests that what we're looking at is a novel pathogen that was accidentally introduced to this country from likely from Europe.
Oh. And tell us how you were able to map out what happens in a bat's body after it's infected with white nose syndrome.
So for the experiment that we summarize in this publication, we used a metabolism measuring technique in which we injected hibernating bats with labeled isotopes to measure energy flux through their bodies. And we were further able to combine this work with two other previously published studies, one from our laboratory, one from a collaborator's laboratory at the University of Winnipeg. And the unique aspect of this work is that it has, for the first time, allowed us to piece together what happens from initial infection all the way through the end stages of the disease. This particular study focused on the initial phases of the disease, which was a happy coincidence of using this metabolism monitoring technique, which typically isn't used in such long-term studies. Mm-hmm. When bats go into hibernation, they slow their metabolism to such a rate that this disease actually progresses very, very slowly. And so in order to adapt this technique, we could only use it at the initial stages of the disease. And we were, I have to say, surprised to learn about just how severe the physiological impacts of this disease are on the bats before we even begin to see the white fungus grow on them that gave the disease its name, white nose syndrome.
So the infected bats are using twice as much energy as they're sleeping. And does that make them wake up?
So we knew before we did this work that the fungal infection disrupted bat hibernation. When bats hibernate, they reduce their metabolic rates. They're actually not sleeping, but they're just in a suppressed, torpid state. And about every 2 weeks or two, they come out of hibernation for about an hour at a time and ramp up their bodily metabolism, perform various functions, possibly excrete waste. They may even sleep during these inter-arousal bouts. And so what we knew before we started this work was that as the disease progresses, the hibernation periods shorten and the amount of arousals increase. And that's very expensive energetically to these bats that have to survive about 6 months without consuming any food or water. Mm-hmm. Our work actually targeted that period before we see the shortening of the torpor bouts and shows that they're at that point entering a severe state of respiratory acidosis. So we see acidification of their blood and accumulation of CO2 as well as other electrolyte changes showing that this is a long-term condition to which their bodies are trying but failing to compensate. And then we also were able to document that even before they are exhibiting behaviors that we know would increase their energy consumption, that they are already using twice as much energy as their healthy, uninfected counterparts.
Using up all that energy, how does that lead to their death?
So the bats enter hibernation for about a six-month winter period. They don't eat during hibernation, and they have a very tight energy budget. They have to, for reasons that we don't all well understand, undergo these arousal periods, and that's very tightly calibrated such that they can undergo their normal hibernation physiology and still make it until spring emergence without having to consume any food. And so with this disease, if you accelerate that energy consumption process, and maybe there's only 10, 20% at most extra energy budget or backup in their fat reserves, what you have is bats that can no longer survive the entire hibernation season until spring emergence. And so we have animals that are starving to death in their hibernacula.
Well, now that you know that it's a fungus and you know the methodology, is there anything you can do for the bats?
So it still remains a very complicated problem. And I think if you had told a human doctor, dermatologist, at the point when we discovered that white nose syndrome was a fungal disease that was causing millions of bats, even upwards of 90% or greater of specific populations, to perish over the course of a single winter. And at the time, maybe the closest analog that you would have to this bat disease in humans would be athlete's foot. So I think if you would tell a dermatologist that athlete's foot was going to be the next human pandemic, I think they would look at you like you were a little bit crazy. Mm-hmm. And so this work at least is now putting a full mechanistic framework on what is happening to the bats from initial infection all the way through the endpoint of the disease. And some things that in order to solve those problems likely involves very complex solutions that also we do know that we can save or cure individual bats. But what we need to look for are these larger solutions that can benefit bat populations, larger bat populations as a whole. But in the meantime, we do know that protecting bat habitat has great benefits to supporting these populations and supporting the natural evolution of surviving bats, which we are seeing. We know that we shouldn't be disturbing hibernating bats, as well as especially, and this is something that we've been instituting for multiple years now, is exercising appropriate biosecurity when we move between caves, either if we're recreational cavers or if we're biologists that are studying these bats. All evidence likely suggests that humans were the cause that introduced this pathogen to North America in the first place. And so I believe it's our responsibility to do all that we can to avoid spreading it further beyond the distance that the bats can already move it on their own.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking with David Bleihert, who is talking about some research published about what kills, what we finally figured out that what was killing all those bats. And you're saying to us that there's really, you can treat, if it's like athlete's foot, you can treat a bat here, treat a bat there. But if you're talking about hundreds of thousands and millions of bats, it's just nature taking its course. It's too late, basically.
Well, something else that we are looking at is trying to understand why certain populations are surviving in the face of this disease, why certain species are surviving in the face of this disease, as well as I mentioned, the likely source of this pathogen is Europe, or at least that's the only other continent on which we know that the pathogen occurs. And European bats are also surviving in the face of this pathogen, although at the same time, European bats generally exist in much smaller populations than at least our northeastern populations historically existed.
Mm-hmm. Is there any natural predator or something else that, you know, could take on the fungus?
So that's actually a very interesting idea. There are other pathogens, for example, viruses that infect fungi, and I believe there is or was recently a grant funded by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to look at what are called mycoviruses, and that's one mechanism that could be potentially used as a biocontrol.
Mm-hmm. Is anybody working on that?
Yes. I think there's a group at Ohio State University that's recently begun to work on that angle of management.
I guess the good news, if there is any good news, and this is, as you say, it's not all the bat species that are being killed by the white nose syndrome.
That's correct. We're seeing in the European populations as well as in North America that some of the bat species that have larger body sizes, perhaps they have more reserves and greater ability to survive in the face of this disease. So the little brown bat, one of the species most greatly impacted, only weighs between, say, 5 and 9 grams. So literally just a small stack of pennies is the total weight of these animals. And so you could imagine that if their winter hibernation budget is 1 gram of extra fat, they can go through that very quickly with these extra arousals or other disturbances to hibernation behavior caused by the disease.
That's amazing. So are you saying then that the larger bats are doing better?
Yes. So in North America, we have the big brown bat, which seems to tolerate a much wider range of hibernation conditions. And it's very possible that we could see increases in big brown bat populations as little brown bat populations contract. We've also seen, interestingly, in an endangered species called the Virginia big-eared bat, as of 10 years ago, there were maybe only 25,000 of those individuals of that species remaining on the planet. And we've since emergence of white nose syndrome seen steady increases in Virginia big bat population, Virginia big-eared bat populations. And these bats are actually persisting in the same caves in which little brown bats are dying.
Well, we've run out of time, but there is some hope for the bigger bats. Thank you, David Blehart. Good luck to you in your studies with the bats.
Thank you very much.